Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Iran's top negotiator in the JCPOA revival talks says the date and venue of the next round of the negotiations are being finalized with the EU. Danish police say three people were killed and several others injured in the Copenhagen mall shooting, adding three of the wounded are in critical condition. Also ahead, a new video shows U.S. police officers involved in the fatal shooting of an unarmed black man in Ohio shot him dozens of times after he fled a traffic stop. Hello and welcome. We are coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you with us. Iran's top negotiator in the talks to revive the 2015 deal says Tehran and the European Union are finalizing the time and location of the next round of negotiations. Ali Bagheri-Kani said the talks will continue based on an agreement reached between Iran and the other side, namely the European Union coordinator for the deal. That after Iran held indirect talks with the United States and the Qatari capital last week, that were brokered by the EU. Iran and the remaining signatories have held several rounds of talks aimed at reviving the deal since April last year, but the process stalled in March this year over what Iran called Washington's excessive demands. The former U.S. president unilaterally pulled out of the accord in 2018 and reinstated sanctions against Iran. Tehran says the deal will be restored provided that Washington acts realistically. Iran also demands guarantees that the U.S. will not torpedo the deal again. Iran is wrapping up the Week of American Human Rights. The annual occasion marks a series of tragic incidents that killed Iranian people and statesmen where the U.S. was directly or indirectly involved. Youssef Jaloli reports from Tehran.
Highlighting the United States' rights violations at the former U.S. Embassy in Tehran, which the Islamic Republic calls the Den of Espionage. Every year in late June and early July, Iranian activists get together to commemorate what they call the American Human Rights Week, to recount instances of U.S. rights abuses in Iran.
United States, who is, you know, shouting the human right, we think that this is just a, you know, slogan without any background. And because when it's go to the Iranian people, we think we have seen that these people have been targeted, and we do not receive any apology about that.
The week-long occasion marks a series of tragic incidents, all falling within the same time frame, killing hundreds of Iranians in the early years after the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Rights activists say in all of those instances, the footprints of the U.S. can be traced. One of the most tragic incidents was the 1988 shooting down of an Iranian airliner by the U.S. Navy, which killed all of the 290 people on board the doomed plane. More than three decades on, and Iran is still waiting for an apology from Washington. Rights activists believe the U.S. has not abandoned its double standards regarding human rights.
We know that more than 30 countries have received the negative sanctions from the United States. Sanction is something that violates the human rights, the right of the development, right of the education, right of the health.
The American Human Rights Week also marks the 1981 bombing of the headquarters of Iran's Islamic Republic Party, carried out by the formidable Mojahedin-e-Khalq terrorist organization, known as the MKO. 73 leading officials, including the then Justice Chief Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti, were killed in the blast. The Islamic Republic says the MKO is responsible for killing 12,000 Iranians in different terror attacks. In 2012, the U.S. and Europe delisted the MKO as a terrorist entity, and since then, they have been taking part in the terror group's annual summits in Paris.
They have withdrawn the MKO from the blacklist, and this withdrawal paved the way for the Americans, not only for the Americans, but also for the MKO, to extend their own terrorist operations through the facilities that they are provided from the Americans and also from the European territories.
The 1987 chemical bombardment of Iran's city of Sardasht is another incident that falls on the same period in the Iranian calendar. Iraq's chemical weapons were reportedly produced using materials supplied by the U.S. and other Western countries.
Activists here say Washington has shrugged off its crimes in Iran. And that's why they observe the American Human Rights Week every year to take a jab at the U.S. for its selective approach toward human rights. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
The International Federation of Journalists says it will be a partner in a lawsuit filed against the Israeli regime at the International Criminal Court. The case was brought following the murder in May of veteran Palestinian journalist Shirin Abu Akla by the regime's troops in the occupied West Bank city of Jenin. The journalist syndicate says it succeeded in exposing Israel's acts of aggression against media professionals and the Palestinian people. The Attorney General of the Palestinian Authority has confirmed that an Israeli soldier was behind the killing of Abu Akla. Last month, Palestinian Foreign Minister Riyad al-Maliki handed the ICC prosecutor the official outcome of the Palestinian investigation into the journalist's killing. The top diplomat has demanded criminals responsible for targeting civilians, children, women, journalists, doctors, and other protected groups be brought to justice at the international court. A young Palestinian man has succumbed to the wounds he suffered during clashes with Israeli forces. 19-year-old Kamal Abdullah Alawna came from the northern occupied West Bank city of Jenin. He was shot in the abdomen and right hand after Israeli forces raided the Flashpoint city on Saturday. Kamal was named after his brother, who was also killed by Israeli forces in 2003. At least 77 Palestinians, including 15 children, have been killed by the regime forces this year, 28 of them in Jenin. Israel forces regularly carry out raids to allegedly make arrests in populated Palestinian communities. The raids have grown more violent and frequent since a number of deadly anti-Israeli operations in recent months. A Roma Loch correspondent, Mona Kandil, says the young Palestinian killed by Israeli troops in Jenin was shot both in the stomach and in the arm.
Well, Israeli forces raided the village of Jabaa in Jenin yesterday, and there were clashes between Israeli forces and Palestinian youths, according to our sources there. Kamal Alawni, 19-year-old Palestinian, was shot in the stomach and his arm, and he was transferred to Ibn Sina Hospital. Today, he succumbed to his injuries. And as you have mentioned, Kamal was named, after his brother. Kamal Alawni, his brother, was shot dead by the Israeli forces in 2003. Then his mother, named the other child also, Kamal Alawni. Today, it's a tragic, incident for this Palestinian family and the mother to lose two of her sons having the same name. As you have mentioned, over 77 Palestinians have been killed by the Israeli troops since the beginning of this year. Almost 50 Palestinians were shot dead by the Israeli soldiers since March up till the day, including children.
A shooting incident at a shopping center in the Danish capital, Copenhagen, leaves three people dead and several wounded, three in critical condition. Police say a 22-year-old Danish man has been arrested, adding there's currently no indication of the presence of other shooters. The police say they can't rule out the deadly incident was an act of terrorism. Officers were sent to the shopping mall soon after the shooting. People were initially advised to remain inside and await assistance. A number of people were reportedly taken to hospital for treatment. Local media published images showing heavily armed police at the scene, as well as people running out of the mall. NATO countries and Russia have been fighting an information war over events in Ukraine. While major Western media outlets are focused on the loss of life and damage from Russia's military campaign, there are Western journalists who are offering an alternative view of the events. Johnny Miller reports on a German journalist facing jail for reporting Ukrainian atrocities in the country's east.
Alina Lipp, a German journalist who has been reporting from the pro-Russian Donbass region of Ukraine for over 6 months. She recently received charges from the German legal system threatening her with 3 years in jail.
On 24th of February, I shared on my Telegram channel the news that, or I said that Ukraine is killing civilians already for 8 years. And I also said that this is a genocide and that people here in Donbass support the special operation of Russia. And this is a criminal act for Germany.
But Ukraine has been killing civilians here for 8 years. That's just
incontrovertible. That's a fact. I'm filming here for half a year now, and I'm living in Donetsk, and I'm hearing all the day this shelling around me, and this is not Russia.
And the other one, it says there is that you said that most people here support the separatists. That's a fact as well.
That's a fact, yeah, of course.
A few days after Alina's charge sheet was issued, the main German TV channel ARD ran a story reporting that the Russian army was bombing Donetsk, but then it was the Ukrainian army. The next day, the channel published a retraction and apology. It's not clear how many people who saw the report also saw the retraction.
The courts have also taken €1,600 out of Alina's bank account, money given to her by members of the public who are appreciative of her work. They also say that she is not allowed to defend herself at a hearing. Now, I've read the document, and the only conclusion I can draw from it is that either the German courts are trying to prosecute honest journalists, or that, frankly, they don't have even the most basic grasp of international politics. I'm not sure which one is more damaging to the credibility of the German legal system.
They just want to put me in prison for 3 years, but not hear me out. I mean, what? It's unbelievable. And especially they open this case because I'm sharing my opinion. So there's no free speech anymore in Germany.
Luis Cervera, an independent Spanish-Russian journalist who has been reporting on the suffering of the Donbass people at the hands of the Ukrainian army.
At first, I received a lot of hate comments, hate in general. Then I received also harassment from different people, pursued me. They published my phone number or my private information. They even published an address of a flat where I used to live.
While Julian Assange faces the prospect of spending the rest of his life in jail, he is not the only journalist under threat of imprisonment for telling the truth. Alina, like many other independent journalists, have been deplatformed from some social media outlets and has had her PayPal account suspended. Anti-war sites Consortium News and Mint Press have also had their PayPal accounts suspended in an attempt to cut off funding.
The job of a journalist is to uncover stories so that society can debate and implement policy based on their findings. Now, while mainstream outlets don't even send reporters to this part of Ukraine, the few Western reporters who are here risk their lives and their reputations to uncover important truths. For that, they risk being deplatformed, smeared, or sent to jail simply for doing their job. There's increasingly a worrying campaign by tech companies, governments, and courts to strangle anti-war dissent in the West. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
In Berlin, hundreds of people march into the streets to discourage the German government from intervention in the Ukraine war. The demonstrators carried banners denouncing arms supplies to Ukraine as well as nuclear weapons. Germany has offered substantial support to Ukraine, sending billions of dollars in military aid and heavy weaponry. That's in line with a policy adopted by certain Western governments to support Ukraine. Those governments include France, Britain, Canada, and Spain. The United States has so far allocated nearly $7 billion to military assistance for Ukraine. Russia has always warned such armed deliveries would only fuel the flames of war. Moscow has cut gas exports to Italy by 15%. The Italian government has played down the consequences of Russia's decision, but there are serious concerns among people about surging energy prices.
The recent decision by Moscow to cut its gas supply to Rome by 15%, which was announced by fuel giant Eni earlier this week, did not catch the Mario Draghi's government off guard, albeit consumer confidence in Italy is at its lowest level in over 20 years. On Saturday, Italy's ecological transition minister Roberto Cingolani said he remains confident that filling underground gas storage to 90% by winter, a requirement recently adopted by the Council of the European Union to strengthen the bloc's energy security, is still a feasible target. However, Minister Cingolani argued he expects prices to further surge, particularly after a temporary closure of the Nord Stream pipeline for maintenance.
We are definitely concerned over our gas supplies. Having said that, underground gas storage on our territory has been filled to almost 60%. So, let me tell you, we are doing fine in that respect.
Italy is trying to wean itself off Russian gas, which currently accounts for 40% of total gas imports. That's why prices in the country were 8% higher in June than a year earlier, marking the highest one-month increase in prices since 1986. The energy crisis has been compounded by an unprecedented drought that is sweeping through Italy's northern and central regions. Experts have warned the drought will reduce the country's hydropower output by 60% by the end of this year.
The problems are multiple, and we will not only face the energy crunch and the water shortage, but also the financial turmoil that will inevitably hit the international markets. Let's sit tight, because a financial shock is on the way, and it will start from the US as usual.
Lately, Prime Minister Draghi has been facing problems protecting the government coalition that supports him. A rift has opened up with former Prime Minister Giuseppe Conte. Also, former Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini has reportedly taken up arms against the executive. A government collapse at this very stage could have grave repercussions for Italy's social stability. Max Civili, Rome.
Gruesome pictures of another act of U.S. police brutality against black Americans. Footage shows 8 police officers were involved in a shooting that killed an unarmed black man in Ohio last week. The footage shows 25-year-old Jalen Walker was hit while jumping out of a car and running away from police during a traffic stop. Police claim a gunshot was fired from the car, but the attorney for the victim's family says there is no evidence Walker fired a gun. He stressed that police body camera footage shows Walker running. When they gunned him down, the victim was eventually pronounced dead in the parking lot where he fell. Well, that's a wrap for this edition of World News. V, thanks for your company. Stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Organizing to undo Biden's deadly indifference and Abbott's active assaults is the only way forward, says Claudia E. Munoz Castellano, activist, in an article published under the heading, U.S. Immigration Policy is to Blame for the Horrific Mass Death in San Antonio. Here's the story. 100 human beings were inside an 18-wheeler without water or air conditioning in the blistering 100-degree Texas heat. 50 of them are now dead. 16 more people were taken to a hospital, including 4 children. That was in San Antonio, Texas. This is the deadliest of such tragedies in recent years, but it is not the first. In 2003, 19 migrants were found dead inside 18-wheelers in Victoria, Texas. In 2017, there were 10 migrants found dead in 18-wheelers, also in San Antonio. Summer is the peak season of deadly state-produced violence. Anybody who has done decarceration work will tell you that summer is one of the most dreaded times for heavily policed and imprisoned communities. Summer is also when the most migration-related deaths occur. 2 hours from San Antonio, a migrant attempting to reach a local ranch for a drink of water was found dead in Kenny County, Texas. The sheriff's office report states it's the fifth dead illegal alien so far this year in the county. The disregard for migrant lives has never been clearer in the history of the United States. The news reported heat stroke and dehydration as the main causes of death in San Antonio, Texas. Though that's certainly what autopsies will reveal, to blame the heat or the smugglers alone would be to dishonor the human beings whose lives have been robbed by local, state, and federal immigration policy. Whether related to border crossing or detention, every single migration-related death is preventable. Recently, Texas Governor Greg Abbott took to Twitter to blame Biden for the death. The way in which migrant lives are used as political pawns denies people basic respect and dignity even in death. As a formerly undocumented immigrant organizer who has called Texas home for the past 20 years, a migrant told you that Americans see this from the ground. One of those men is actively trying to kill people, while the other one was leaving other people to die. In March of last year, Governor Abbott launched Operation Lone Star, a $4 billion political operation that deployed law enforcement and National Guard members from all over the state and a few other states to flood border communities and arrest migrants with misdemeanor trespassing charges to be sent to state prisons for up to a year. Over 3,000 people have been charged and imprisoned through Operation Lone Star since its inception. This is Abbott's attempt to create his own immigration enforcement and deterrence program. On both fronts, there is only been inaction whose end result, predictably, is premature death. There is often a villain and a savior narrative along partisan lines that defines the dialogue on immigration policy in the United States of America. But these deaths remind people of James Baldwin's powerful statement, who said, "Those in power in the U.S. are responsible for this violence. They are the authors of devastation, regardless of whether their actions are considered a crime by the legal system, and regardless of whether they aggressively push xenophobic agendas or fail to intervene to protect the victims of those policies." Just last week, Democrats in Congress approved an amendment to the DHS budget bill that would extend the racist and inhumane Title 42 policy that prevents people from seeking asylum at the border. President Biden failed to end the policy when he first came into office, knowing full well that it was put in place by Stephen Miller to end migration. Biden's hesitation enabled Governor Abbott and other Republicans to politicize the issue, creating the conditions for this type of tragedy to take place. With Title 42 and other policies for closing safer pathways, migrants will continue to enter the U.S. through pathways like the one that ended in mass death in San Antonio. As a political system, Texas is a violence and death-oriented state. From the attacks on youth to Uvalde tragedy to the trigger ban on rights, the U.S. state mass produces death and then spreads it to other places. The federal government, while publicly showing outrage and disdain for places like Texas and the broader South, is an accomplice, an enabler of the violence that robbed migrants of their lives in San Antonio recently. The embrace of policies that orient toward care and health rather than exclusion and violence could have prevented the mass deaths. Yet, even though those lives are robbed by death-making policies, those human beings were much more than that. So are the survivors. Those who died are human beings, with loved ones, with a strength, with hope, with faith, with stories that should matter to all of people. Their search for a more bearable life, for survival, for resources, and for sustenance was met with death instead of welcoming and care. The policies and technologies that facilitate death in Texas will not remain within state borders, and organizing to undo Biden's deadly indifference and Abbott's active assaults is the only way forward.
Food for thought. Hello everyone, and since we're still basking in the blessed wedding anniversary celebrations of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, and Hazrat Fatima Zahra, peace be upon her, here is what Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, said while solemnizing the nuptials of his immaculate daughter and his infallible son-in-law. May Allah bless you, prosper you, and produce much good from you.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio.
Thank you.
log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, Limits of Good Manner. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the limitations or limits and boundaries of good manner. When we talk about the limits of good manner, we said that the first limit was to deal with the mu'mineen as your brothers and have mercy upon it. The second limit and the boundary of the good manners is to how to deal with the non-believers and those who are the polytheists maybe or maybe the kuffar. When we see the Islamic text, we see that in the Quran, when Allah talks to the Musa alayhi salam, the Prophet Musa, he says, اِذْهَبَا إِلَىٰ فِرْعَوْنَ إِنَّهُ طَغَى. O Moses, or the Prophet Moses, you and your brother Harun must go towards Fir'aun or Pharaoh. Why? Because he has become a rebel. فَقُولَ لَهُ قَوْلًا لَيِّنًا. And talk to him in a soft manner. لَعَلَّهُ يَتَذَكَّرُ أَوْ يَخْشَى. Maybe he learns from it, or maybe he gets fear of what you're talking about, or he has the fear of you. So when we look at the Islamic text, we see that Islam teaches us that when you need to talk to the non-believer, when you're talking to someone who is maybe a polytheist or non-believer, then you need to use a soft language. You need to talk in a soft way, and you need to softly speak to them so that you can call them towards the right path. When you're talking to them, you talk them in a soft way so that they can get closer to you. They can learn from it. They can learn the message that Islam talks about softness. Islam, when it deals with the kuffar, it has a soft corner so that they can come towards us. Therefore, when we are dealing with the non-Muslims, we must observe these messages which are given in the Quran, inshallah. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of limits of good manner in Islam. When we talk about the limits of good manner, we said that we must have a good manner and we must talk lightly and softly with the kuffar, with the non-believers. And we should not have a way of talking to them that they feel guilty when we are talking to them. We should call them towards Islam in a soft way. And this is what Islam talks about. We have many examples in the history that, for example, once the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam, he was sitting with his companions and a Jew came to the Prophet and he said that the Prophet of Islam or the Prophet of Islam owes me something, and he must face the punishment because he did not pay his debt on time. And this is what he said. Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said that I never had anything, I never took anything from you, so I do not owe anything, and I'm not guilty at any cost. But if you say, let's sit here, and if you have some witnesses, bring your witnesses, and we wait until your witnesses comes. And the history says that they sat there for half a day when the sun came to the middle of the sky, and it was too hot. This guy stood up and he said that, I witness that you are the true messenger of Allah, because you never became angry of what I have said, and you were after the logical and the intellectual way of solving the issue that I presented to you. And I witness that you are the true messenger of God, for which the Old Testament or the books, our holy books, have witnessed. And therefore he became Muslim. Therefore, there are many other examples in the history that we can follow, and we can deal with the non-Muslims with a good manner so that they become Muslim, inshallah. Thanks for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Thanks for listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.com/EN Call of Islam page. Till another episode, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
In Brazil, a 100-year-old man has broken the world record for the longest spell working at a single company. Walter Orthman has entered the Guinness World Record books for working at the same fabric company for an astonishing period of 84 years. He started on the factory floor before moving into administration and later on into the sales management. Despite his extraordinary accomplishment, Orthman's advice for those looking for a long and fulfilling professional life is surprisingly routine.
You have to like to work. I started to work with that willingness and fighting spirit. You also have to start working on something you like to do. You can't just do any job to say that you're working. That doesn't work. You're not going to be able to stand it. You have to look for a job that you like to do, and there you won't even feel the time passing. That's what happened with me. I started working here and I liked it. I worked my way up from point to point until I got to the position I'm in today.
Ortman says his secret to a long life and breaking the record is having a healthy lifestyle and staying away from junk food. He says he avoids sugar and salt as much as possible and tries to keep a diet that is healthy for the mind and soul. In order to stay sharp, Orthman says he does stretches and maintains physical activity. A bridge too scary for many, but just the right place for those with a head for heights. Vietnam has opened the world's longest glass bottom bridge to the public.
The now recorded longest glass-bottom cliffside pathway, and it's spectacular, the engineering required to build that into the side of a cliff but maintain all the features of nature, the greenery, the rock, has been an amazing project, very successful, and I think it will attract a lot of tourists.
the White Dragon Suspension Bridge fittingly opened with a dragon dance. The structure is longer than the previous record holder in China and has two sections. One stretches over 630 meters between two mountains, while the other runs around a cliffside. Visitors can look straight down at the valley 150 meters below. The structure is safe and made from three layers of 40 millimeter tempered glass. With soaring fuel prices, the importance of solar-powered vehicles is on the rise. Now a Kashmiri math teacher has gone viral for creating a car powered by solar energy. The car, which is fully covered with solar panels, uses sunlight to charge its battery. The vehicle also has a braking system that regenerates power to its batteries. The inventor of the car, Bilal Ahmed, says he has spent about $19,000 for his project and has not used external funds.
It was my dream to invent a solar car for the people of Kashmir. It took me 13 years to complete my dream. I'm thankful to the Almighty I succeeded in this project.
Bilal says he has built the car manually and without any automation. He hopes to put his fully automatic car into mass production to create jobs for local people.
Just like humans and animals, plants get sick too. But what do you do with an ill plant? An Indian man has found an answer to that. He has opened an emergency room only for plants in Amritsar, a city in India's Punjab state. A tax officer and his wife have set up the Pushpa Tree and Plant Hospital. In Pushpa, they have expert biologists and tree lovers on hand to provide the so-called sick patients with their essential nutrients. The clinic aims to treat any and every disease and even has an emergency vehicle on call for unhealthy trees around the city. The officer's wife says, just as we humans bleed, breathe, and need cures, plants also bleed, breathe, and need cures.
We provide approximately 32 various services for plants and trees, like if there's a nail in the tree, how to take out that nail. Deep poisoning of the trees. Yes, you heard it right. There are people who poison the trees. Again, if the tree is not bearing fruits, there's an attack of mealybugs or another insects. That's also cured here. If the trees or plants are dying and you're unable to take care of them, even that problem is sorted out.
Only a month into the hospital's operation, Rohit Mehra and his team of 20 volunteers have already received more than 300 queries. The hospital is also completely free of charge. Staff at the National Zoo of Cuba in the capital city of Havana are celebrating a new arrival of a rare baby white rhinoceros. The little calf, named Al, quickly became popular among other animals in the park after he was born. He is part of a conservation program that will add to a gene bank for future breeding. Al is the second white rhinoceros to be born in captivity in 18 years. The park is home to 8 white rhinos and 4 black ones. Zoo staff say the park has one of the largest exhibits of this mammal among zoos in Latin America. White rhinos are endangered species and their population has dwindled due to illegal poaching and environmental destruction.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.
Persian fallow deer is a unique but endangered species known for its sleek and spotted body. In this report, our correspondent Youssef Jalali takes us on a quick tour around one of the world's few protected shelters of Persian fallow deer in Iran's city of Sari.
We had to keep quiet and avoid making any sounds to film them, as they are shy and swift, and the slightest sound could send them sprinting and jumping away. Over 60 Persian fallow deer roam in Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Iran's northern city of Sari. The endangered species is carefully protected here to be safe from predators and poachers.
The Persian fallow deer is native to Iran's Khuzestan province, but due to loss of habitat and threats posed to them by predators such as jackals and wild cats, they are endangered and need to be protected in semi-natural refuge like this one.
Persian fallow deer are mainly indigenous to open woodland areas spanning from East Mediterranean coasts to West and Southwest Iran. By 1875, they had gone extinct in all of their main habitats, except in southwest Iran. After a captive breeding program, the population has rebounded from only a handful of deer in the 1960s to over 200 individuals in Iran.
Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge is a 55 hectares wide. It was introduced in 1962 as a shelter for the Persian fallow deer when the species was on the brink of extinction. At that time, five deer were captured and translocated to this refuge. Over the past six decades, their number have been multiplied through captive breeding.
The Persian fallow deer is a rare ruminant mammal belonging to the family Cervidae. They're physically larger than other fallow deer, and their antlers are bigger and less palmate. Their special beauty has turned this sanctuary into a hot tourist attraction in Iran's north.
This sanctuary is a tourist destination for visitors who would like to see the Hyrkanian forests in Iran's north and at the same time enjoy the wildlife and learn about efforts made to save the Persian fallow deer from extinction.
In 2015, the Persian fallow deer was registered in the IUCN Red List of Threatened Species. Dashtinaz authorities hope through continued captive breeding, the population of these special creatures will soon reach the desired number, and hopefully they will be reintroduced to their natural habitat in southwest Iran.
While they live far from their original habitat, these alluring creatures feel at home here, where they will be safe from the dangers lurking outside, which may lead to their extinction. So here, Persian fallow deer continue to embellish the nature and charm visitors with their beauty. Youssef Jalali from Dashtinaz Wildlife Refuge in Sari.
Catching fish makes you forget even the most complex problems. But think the moment you catch the strangest one. Well, a Cambodian fisherman has caught what researchers say is the world's biggest freshwater fish ever recorded. The giant fish, which weighs around 300 kilograms and 4 meters long, was caught last week from the Mekong River. The female stingray was released back into water after being electronically tagged to allow scientists to monitor her movement and behavior. The fish was named Barami, meaning full moon in the Khmer language. An American fish biologist, Dana Lee, says the data collected from Barami can help protect the species and its habitat.
We got a call this morning at breakfast that they had caught a giant stingray here at Coprea. So we dropped everything. People came up from Phnom Penh, and we're here now just at sunset, just tagged the giant 330-kilogram giant stingray here in the Mekong River, and released it here right at sunset.
The stingray dethrones the former record holder, a 290-kilogram catfish found in northern Thailand in 2005. More than 1,000 species live in the Mekong River. The famous waterway originates in China and twists south through parts of Thailand, Laos, Myanmar, Cambodia, and Vietnam. Scientists have warned that plastic waste and dam threaten wildlife even in the deepest stretches of the Mekong. Geologists are rejoicing over a new discovery. A 290-million-old fossil forest has accidentally been found in southern Brazil. A team of geologists had been sent to the state of Paraná to investigate the rocks there. To their surprise, they were able to find over 160 logs of lycophytes, an extinct variety of the vascular plant subgroup. It's quite rare occurrence that a large number of fossils of the plant were found preserved in upright position for such a long time. The forest itself was discovered in 2018 when a street was being constructed over there. So far, only two other similar collections have been found in smaller forest areas of Brazil and Argentina.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
A new poll published recently shows that nearly 6 in 10 Americans believe that former U.S. President Donald Trump bears responsibility for the attack on the United States Capitol building nearly 1.5 years ago. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Chris Walker, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Poll Shows Half of Americans Say Trump Should Be Charged for January 6 Involvement. Here's the story. A new poll published recently shows that nearly 6 in 10 Americans believe that former President Donald Trump bears responsibility for the attack on the United States Capitol building nearly 1.5 years ago. According to the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs research poll, which was conducted between June 23rd and 27th, 58% of Americans say Trump bears a great deal or quite a bit of responsibility for the attack perpetrated by a mob of his loyalists on January 6, 2021. Another 12% say he bears a moderate amount of responsibility for what happened, while only 28% say he doesn't bear much or any responsibility at all. In terms of who bears the most responsibility for the attack among the political figures, the poll asked about Trump received the highest numbers. A plurality of Americans, about 46%, say Republicans in Congress were more responsible than not for the attack, with less than a third, about 30%, saying they weren't that responsible. Just 22% blame Democrats in Congress for the event that transpired, with 51% saying Democrats bore little or no responsibility for the attack. Only one of the group of people, the actual individuals involved in the attack, received a higher rating than Trump on the question of who was responsible for the January 6 attack, with 78% of respondents in the poll saying the January 6 mob bore a great amount or quite a bit of responsibility for what happened that day. Attitudes on the hearings and on Trump specifically run largely along partisan lines, with 92% of Democrats saying the former president should be blamed quite a bit or a great deal versus just 21% of Republicans who think so. A plurality of Americans, about 48% according to the poll, believe that Trump should be charged with a crime for his involvement on January 6 and the days leading up to it. Only 31% said he shouldn't be charged, while 20% say they didn't know enough to have an opinion. These opinions come even though many in the poll admitted that they hadn't been paying attention to the January 6 House Committee's hearings on the attack. 56% of respondents said they have been following news about the hearings, but when asked if they have watched or listened to the hearings, 57% of those surveyed said they had not. Notably, the poll's findings were obtained before a surprise January 6 committee hearing that was held recently, which included explosive testimony from former Trump White House aide Cassidy Hutchinson, who worked closely with Trump as an assistant to the president's former chief of staff Mark Meadows. Hutchinson revealed many alarming details about Trump's mindset on the day of and in the weeks preceding the January 6 attack, which occurred while Congress was in session to certify the 2020 presidential election results. According to Hutchinson, for example, Trump was furious about his loyalists being denied entry to his Stop the Steal rally outside the White House that morning, even though many of them were carrying weapons, including AR-15 rifles. Trump, who would later encourage his loyalists to descend onto the Capitol, wasn't concerned about the weapons because, according to Hutchinson, Trump knew that the armed mob was not a threat to him. "I don't care that they have weapons," Hutchinson recalled Trump had said. "They're not here to hurt me. Let my people in. They can march to the Capitol from here." Hutchinson also recollected the former president as saying.
Ukraine and Western governments.
Part 1.